Today is April 15th, 2015, and this is episode number 302 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Jeffen, Jeff's personal accountant and future prison visitor. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. You're in trouble, sir. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Hey, were there any documents I needed to get to you so you could actually do my taxes?
Yeah, I'll get them to you later.
Okay, cool. Is it, you know, it's all under control. Oh, boy.
Yeah, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You are in trouble. You know who else is in trouble? Lynda.com, because they're sponsoring us.
It's been great having them as a sponsor.
It has been. No, we love Lynda, and their sponsorship is important. We'll be talking more about them later. You want to just kind of like sort of jump right into it?
We might as well, as long as we're here.
Andy Hertzfeld versus Tim Cook.
Ding, ding. They kind of have opposing views.
They do. You know, we have this ongoing battle over who... I'm torn between saying this for two ways. We had this ongoing battle over Steve Jobs' legacy. The other way I wanted to say it was we have this ongoing battle over who gets to control and shape Steve Jobs' legacy, even though that's not actually... nothing one person can do.
Yeah, but that's not stopping people from trying.
Yeah, because that's what we do, right? That's kind of like that's kind of a human thing to do, right?
Yeah.
You know, when someone who's powerful, someone who had a powerful presence in our lives, someone who had a big impact on our lives, when they pass away, they die, sometimes even just when they leave a company or leave an organization or maybe even leave a family through a divorce or something, the more impact they had, the more desire we have to control their legacy and to shape that legacy.
Yes. I think you're totally right. This is something that we have been doing for thousands of years. We love to create our myths and our stories.
Mm-hmm. And someone like Steve Jobs, who had an extraordinary presence and an extraordinary impact on so many people's lives, both indirectly through his products and directly with the people that he worked with and his family and, you know, his friends and things like that. So, you know, someone like that is going to have... It's understandable that there is a strong desire by lots of folks to control that destiny or to control that legacy. It's understandable.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. We like to look at our past through, well, whatever lenses we choose.
Right. And so, you know... What is bringing all this out now? It's been, what, 3.5 years since Steve died? A little more than 3.5 years? 3 years and 7 months, maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
And, you know, I think the first round came when the Walter Isaacson biography was first published in December. Was it December or November? I think it was December.
Maybe.
Anyway, it was one of the two. It was right after he died.
Yeah.
It was really close. It was rushed to print. It was finished, of course, but it was rushed to release in order to, quite frankly, capitalize on Steve Jobs' death, but also because, I mean, it was a good capitalization because we all wanted to know more. We all wanted to read. All wanted to, you know, it's part of our mourning process.
You know, that's a really good point. Yes, it was a big part of the mourning process for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And that book, we talked about this several times over the you know, intervening years. That book left some people found it wanting, and some people like me, you snoozed through it and couldn't finish it.
Yep.
And I thought it was just a fantastic scholarly work. And, you know, then it turns out that a lot of Steve Jobs's inner circle, we're talking about Tim Cook, Johnny Ive,
Eddie Q,
yeah, Phil Schiller, some, you know, a lot of those folks didn't care for the, that biography. They felt that, like, I think Tim Cook said that it just, you know, retreads well-worn stories, as if the negative stories, as if because they've been told once and discussed many times, it can no longer be talked about, which I don't agree with. I don't agree with at all.
I'm with you. These are parts of his life, and if you're telling a story, if you're documenting his life, well, then these are things that you talk about.
Documenting is a good word there, because Walter Isaacson's biographies, I know that I've said this on this show, I certainly have said it on TDO, he's not a great writer, but I think he's a great biographer. And the reason why I think he's such a good biographer is because he brings all these disparate pieces together, and he really has this knack for contextualizing people very quickly and briefly. And yeah, by giving you this, you know, like every single person that enters the story gets a little bit of context.
Which, that's one thing that I really liked about that book, even though I just couldn't get through it. There were things that I liked. I mean, I really did like that you'd see a new character and it's like, boom, boom, here's two bullet points about who this person is. And it paints a really good picture.
Yeah, and it always, I don't know if he does this consciously or not, but it's always two bullet points. There's two factoids to go with someone to sort of give you a quick idea of who they were. You know, and the more important they are to whatever story he's telling, the more depth he goes into, but you get a minimum of two factoids every time. But the new book, the reason why all this is sort of coming out again is because of Becoming Steve Jobs by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli. And I got to tell you, man, that it is a well-written biography. It is a well-written book. It's good prose. Brent Schlender is a very good writer.
All right. So based on what you're saying right now, I'll go ahead and give this book a shot.
Okay. Fair enough. Although you gave the last book a shot at my urging and you didn't like it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, way to take some of the enthusiasm out of my interest in that book now.
Yeah, you haven't even finished Game of Thrones, brother.
Yeah, but I'm really liking it. That's a really good book.
When did you start that? 4 years ago? 5 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, you're just, I don't even get it, man. Okay, all right. So anyway.
I know, it drives you nuts.
Yeah, sometime you should ask me about my theory on who Jon Snow is.
Oh, okay. I'll ask you, but I should probably at least finish the Game of Thrones.
At the least, yeah. Maybe I'll do a blog post over at Geek Tales.
Oh, yes, do. I think that would be a great thing.
I should do that. I think I will do that before the next book comes out and we actually possibly find. Okay, so anyway, Becoming Steve Jobs, well-written biography. It takes a very different look at Steve Jobs because it focuses, for one thing, it actually focuses a lot on the years at Next and Steve Jobs' years away from Apple.
Oh, no, see, I'm interested now.
And that's actually that's an area of Steve's life that I thought Walter Isaacson didn't pay enough attention to. Like, I was really hoping for a lot more of that than I got from Walter Isaacson's book. So you know, that's kind of it's the central premise of Becoming Steve Jobs is that Steve Jobs was this flawed individual when he was young, and he basically learned how to tame those flaws and better channel his personality quirks into more productive realms while he was away from Apple, and that allowed him to come back to Apple and be the superstar. That's
kind of an important thing.
That's the extraordinarily abridged version of what that book is, and I haven't finished it yet, mind you. But that's pretty much what it's about.
Yeah, but see, that's a really important thing because that whole foundation had to be laid for Steve to come back to Apple and turn the company around and create it into the massive success that it is today.
Okay, so getting back to Steve Jobs' inner circle.
Oh, right, right.
We've got Tim Cook, we've got Johnny. We got the inner circle from the end of his life. Right? They collectively didn't seem to care for Walter Isaacson's book. They thought it painted Steve in a negative light. Tim Cook was saying that it didn't represent the kind and generous person that he knew. And I'd said before that I think it's because he's too close. Because when I read Walter Isaacson's book, I didn't come away with the negative impression that Tim Cook thinks I did.
Well, that's interesting. But okay, that's also I think a real good example of how people perceive whatever it is that's around them. So in this case, Tim Cook didn't like the book, and he felt it painted Steve in a bad light. Therefore, when you read the book, you are seeing Steve painted in a bad light, and that's how you perceive him as well.
Right.
Now, for the part that I read, I didn't see that as painting Steve in a bad light.
I think Walter Isaacson's book was very scholarly and unbiased and objective. I think he presented the information. More importantly, he presented the stories he was told. There were all kinds of quotes based on his many interviews. I think he had 40 interviews with Steve Jobs over the last 2 or 3 years of Steve's life.
Okay, so to me that says that Walter was in a really good position to be able to formulate a profile of who Steve Jobs is from Steve's perspective.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that, I'll just say that again. He presented the stories he was told. So if Tim Cook and Eddie Q and Steve's other very close friends wanted more positive stories about Steve to be included in the book, they probably should have told Walter. That's to be blunt. They probably should have told Walter. I don't think Walter was like getting these stories out of people like Tim Cook, like the story about this is in Becoming Steve Jobs. Tim said he offered Steve Jobs his kidney. Part of his liver.
Okay, there we go.
It's a slightly different thing.
It's like, and Steve, and I have kidneys. You want one?
Steve turned it down. And from Tim's point of view, that's a sign of how incredibly unselfish Steve Jobs was. And, I mean, that's an amazing story. There's no way that Walter Isaacson didn't include that when he knew it. If he knew it.
Right, yeah. Which means he didn't know it.
He didn't know it, yeah. So they probably should have told Walter more of these good stories. But whatever. They do like this book. And that's really why we're talking about it again, because Andy Hertzfeld.
Right, that's where we were going with this, Andy Hertzfeld.
He was part of the original Macintosh team. He's, you know, he's a legend here in Silicon Valley.
He is. Yeah. He's one of the guys behind the original Macintosh.
Yeah. And he worked very closely with Steve Jobs while they were at Apple. And he also counted Steve Jobs as a friend. And I'm delighted. I am perhaps unseemly delighted, or delighted to an unseemly level, that Andy Hertzfeld agrees with me.
So your delight goes to 11.
For sure. He said, and I'm quoting, "Walter's book is brimming with a huge trove of never-before-revealed intimate details of Steve's life. Steve Jobs got the biography that he wanted and deserved, a best-selling, well-written, unbiased, comprehensive account of his life and work by the biographer of Einstein and Franklin." Word.
There you go. That's pretty clear cut right there.
And he also says about Becoming Steve Jobs, again, I'm quoting, In my opinion, their central thesis is simplistic and trite. This is referring to the authors of Becoming Steve Jobs. A reckless upstart can be a visionary leader. In fact, they're usually the best kind. Of course, Steve matured and gained wisdom and insight as he grew older. Most people do. Visionary leader, the thing he purportedly became, is an apt description of his role on the Mac team in 1981. Ed Catmull of Pixar suggests that Steve learned to value teamwork by observing the incredible team at Pixar. But in truth, his entire career was built on deep collaborations, starting with Steve Wozniak in the Apple II, and then with the original Mac team, where he participated in an intense collaboration with more than a dozen passionate colleagues. And so, you know, from Andy Hertzfeld's standpoint, he doesn't like the fact that Becoming Steve Jobs effectively dismisses a lot of Steve's early work as you know, just sort of extraordinarily flawed practice runs for later greatness.
Yeah, I kind of like that perspective.
So I
wouldn't consider the Macintosh a flaw.
Mm-mm. Well, kind of was. It kind of fizzled.
It certainly wasn't the Lisa.
No. No, that's true.
And even though the Mac may not have been the single most biggest selling computer of all time when it launched, how many of their computers are still around that were started that long ago? How many computer lines?
It's true.
And I'm asking without knowing the answer. I'm betting there aren't any others.
Oh, Windows.
Well, no, Windows came. Well, no, that's true. All right. So we do have Windows, and we have the Macintosh. All right, there you go.
Of course, you know, Windows isn't a computer line. Your real question was, but you know, this, Windows is essentially the PC.
Right, yeah. So that's why I'm giving you Windows on that.
Yeah, because hardware doesn't matter on the PC side.
Right.
Hardware, you know.
And if you look at many computers that are made today, boy, hardware doesn't matter.
And hardware makers are interchangeable. They don't matter.
Right. So we have Macintosh and we have Windows.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see this sort of circling of the wagons. We've got, the circling of the wagons for sure on the more recent inner circle side. And then at least one person from the older team saying that no, you guys are wrong. This is a good book. The Walter Isaacson book was good, and if anything, Becoming Steve Jobs is the flawed book. And it's all about trying to shape and control that legacy and people's desires to have their remembrances and images of someone they loved or hated, in this case loved, be the ones that are shared and remembered by time.
Yeah, the version of history that someone prefers is the one they like best.
Yeah, we've brought this. I've written two or three pieces about this now, and we've talked about it a couple of times. And there's something here that is still tickling my brain. There's still I haven't worked it all out. And you know, maybe it's just maybe it's still part of my own mourning process for you know, as a fan of Steve's work. I don't know. There's still something here.
I'm curious to see where this takes you.
Yeah.
I mean, you've offered up some really interesting insights into the books, into the reactions people have had towards the content of both. So that tells me that when you sort this out and figure out what it really is that's still lingering out there for you, it's probably going to be a very interesting piece, which means we'll have a very interesting discussion about it.
Yeah, thanks. I do appreciate that. It's I don't know, it's interesting. The whole thing is interesting, and I don't know. I want to close with this. There is no one look on anyone, on any person who had a big impact on those around them and on the world in particular. I mean, you know, especially if they had a big enough impact to have affected the world, and that certainly is the case with Steve Jobs. And there's no one look that could ever encompass everything. I mean, I enjoyed the book Icon, in part because it focused a lot on what Steve Jobs did when he was at Next. There's a lot of, and Pixar both. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the Walter Isaacson book. I'm enjoying the heck out of Becoming Steve Jobs so far. I want to emphasize again that Brent Schlinger is an excellent writer. It's just such a well-written book. But all of these books are I'll go. You remember the Mac bathroom reader?
Yes, I do. I have one tucked away somewhere.
I do too. Did you read the second book, Apple Confidential, and then Apple Confidential 2.0?
I read part of Apple Confidential and then lost my book, but didn't even do 2.0.
I know, Owen. I've got a copy I can give you.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Owen Linsmeyer was the writer of both of those books. And they're more of a collection of, like, you know, sort of like trivia and facts.
Yeah. The Bathroom Reader was a lot of fun.
The Bathroom Reader is a lot of fun. And Apple Confidential was sort of like the more serious version of that. And those are also two great books to read if you want to know more about who someone like Steve Jobs was and how things worked. So, I mean, it takes a lot of different views towards a lot of different views about someone like Steve Jobs to ever really get a comprehensive look. And the best biographies of him are probably going to be the ones that are compiled 20 or 30 years from now, based upon all this work, based upon things like Jean-Louis Gasset writing about him, or Andy Hertzfeld writing about him, or Susan Kerr, if she were to write about him. Certainly Tim Cook. I bet Tim Cook has more to say about Steve Jobs in the next couple of decades.
Oh, yeah. I bet you're right. And I bet we're going to get some very interesting insights into who Steve was from Tim.
Yeah, and you know, interviews that Regis McKenna has given. I would love for him to just write a book. We should see if Regis McKenna has written a book.
Man, if there's only a tool we could use.
Yeah, something that had access to lots of information. Well, let's research that.
Let's research that. We'll put the interns
get back
on
to
it.
Anyway, but you know, the there are so many people who are still alive who worked with, interacted with, knew, loved, hung out, you know, whatever, with Steve Jobs. There's still a lot more to come about understanding who he was and how he did what he did. And you know how Apple became. You know, there are so many unwritten books about how Apple has become Apple. You know, like all the stuff about Apple University and trying to institutionalize a culture of innovation and I mean this stuff has all been happening, and there's no 1,000-foot view yet.
No, there's not. And there's so much about this company that's fascinating.
And especially when Apple, you know, Apple will eventually stumble, right?
Well, of course. And that will be an important thing to study as well. I mean, Apple's going to be just an incredible college course at some point.
Absolutely. When Apple stumbles and fails at something significantly, especially if the company's value, or you know, if the company just fell apart, and that's likely at some point. I mean, it's not likely at some point; it's inevitable.
Yeah, it, you know, yeah, it every just company on, just it goes away at some point.
Yeah, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. At some point, Apple will obviously stumble. And at that point, there will be all kinds of scholarly works looking at, back at what Apple was and what it became. And you know, so it always takes time and hindsight to truly grok some of these things. And we're still going through that with Steve Jobs.
Yeah, we are. He's been gone for 3-something years. This is an ongoing process of learning who he was.
Really is.
Yeah.
Really is. So, speaking of ongoing processes.
Oh, do tell.
Learning.
Yep.
An ongoing process.
Yes. And, oh, if there is only a place that people could go online to learn so, so much.
But wait, there is.
Do tell.
lynda.com/ACM.
That's right. If people go there, not only can they learn from the massive library, over 3,000 titles that Lynda has, mm-hmm. but they can get 10 days for free.
10 days for free. So what lynda.com does, they have, as you said, over 3,000 different courses, teaching you how to do stuff, how to program, how to use software, how to use spreadsheets.
How to edit audio or video.
How to do design. Do they have any coursework on fonts?
I believe they do.
They have so much stuff. Like, if you lined it all up, you'd be hard-pressed to shake a stick at it.
It's one of my favorite. It'd have to be a pretty big stick.
It's one of my favorite Southernisms, although I misused it. Nonetheless, They've got
check
all,
this out.
Yes.
Font management, central training, font considerations for digital documents, font and type style tricks, font choices, font type and style. Yeah. Using Typekit fonts in your InDesign documents.
Apparently they have some stuff on fonts.
They do.
So if they have some stuff on fonts, they're probably going to have some stuff that you need to learn something for your job, to get a new job, to make your life more rich, to have more fun with a hobby, to just be able to get something done, to just learn something. And that's the thing I love about lynda.com. You can learn, and with their sponsorship of us, you can try it out for free. You can go and learn something for free, and that is so powerful to me. It is so amazing that we get to offer you this. I want you to take them up on it. You get 10 days of access to everything they do, all of those titles, as many as you want during that 10 days, and it's free.
Yeah, you're limited only by your own stamina and the laws of time.
Tardai notwithstanding.
That's true. Yeah, if you have your TARDIS, well, there you go. You're going to get a lot of value out of those 10 free hours.
Is the plural of TARDIS, would it be TARDAI? It's not really Latin.
It would be TARDISes because it's actually an acronym. Time and relative dimension and space.
That's a good point. But can I say TARDAI? Anyway, so lynda.com/ACM. Try it out for free for 10 days. Go and learn something. This is your opportunity to go and learn how to do something. That piece of software you've always had sitting on your Mac or your PC, if that's how you roll. That you know, it's like, it's complicated. And I'll deal with it later. Well, go deal with it now because you can do it for free. You can learn how to do it. You can start learning how to program. You know that great idea you had for a game? Go learn how to code it.
Write the game. Then tell us about it.
Yes. Yeah, and write us and tell us what it is that you learned how to do at lynda.com. That's not part of our sponsorship. We just want to know.
That's true. We're genuinely interested.
Because we think learning is cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
All right, lynda.com/ACM, 10 days free. We appreciate their sponsorship. We want you to take advantage of it.
Yes, go do it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Right as soon as you're done listening to this show.
Right. That, yeah, wait.
Or pause.
Wait. No. Listen to the show.
Okay.
And then do it.
Okay.
Okay. We'll remind you at the end.
We're good like that.
Yeah, we are good like that. So, Apple Watch. It's been a big week.
Yes, it has.
What do we have here? We have Friday. We had the pre-orders.
Right. We both got our pre-orders in within the first 5 minutes, and we pushed out, what, 4 to 6 weeks? Something like that?
Yeah, something like I think I'm at, 4 to 6 weeks, May 13th to the 27th for me.
Yep, that's what I am too.
Right. Dave Hamilton got his in, and we all got the same watch. No, you got the smaller one.
I did. I went with the 38 millimeter space gray sport.
And Dave and I both went with the 42 millimeter space gray. And Dave got his order in 3 minutes before I did, and was promised delivery in the first batch, April 26th to like May 8th or something like that.
And I was at the same time as you, maybe just slightly before, but so right about the same time.
Yeah, and that was just in the first few minutes. My order went through at 12:06, Dave's went through at 12:03, and yours went through at 12:05.
Yeah.
And then within 30 minutes, everything was showing June and July.
That was crazy.
It was pretty crazy. Pretty big opener.
Yeah, and the scary thing for me was ordering right away, having that much of a shipping delay. And I was thinking, man, I just bought a watch that I haven't ever tried on. So if I chose wrong, I'm kind of screwed. Turns out I chose wisely.
Because you went and tried one on the next day.
The same day.
Same day, right. Yeah, well, sorry, that was the next day for me.
Oh, right. Same day for me, next day for you. Yeah.
Yeah, and I napped.
Yeah, different time zones.
Right. Yeah, Dateline. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before we get to the try-on stuff, so Apple sold, so according to one estimate based on a fairly large sample size, Apple sold some 957,000 Apple Watches in the U.S. alone.
975,000.
975,000. Sorry, little dyslexia there for me. And that would be just in the U.S. It was also released in 7 other markets. The U.S. was probably going to be the biggest one that it was released in. And which, you know, pretty good bet that it was at least 1 million units on the first day. Apple hasn't announced since if it's those initial pre-orders, which is interesting. It seems like Apple would have announced that.
You'd think they would. I'm guessing that they are waiting for their earnings report, and they'll talk about Apple Watch sales at that point.
Yeah, that's possible. That's next week, right?
So, I believe it's next week.
Hmm. All right. Well, nonetheless, we probably will definitely get some pre-order numbers during the earnings report. I'm sure you're correct there. And
you know, they may be waiting until the 24th so that they can say actual launch sales as one number.
Well, so okay, it's already the biggest launch in Apple's history. Took iPhone 74 days to get to 1 million units. Took iPad 28 days to reach 1 million units, and assuming this report from this third-party company is even close to accurate, Apple hit 1 million units in the first day for Apple Watch. That makes it the best new product launch in Apple's history.
That's pretty impressive. I mean, this is an untested market for Apple. Overall, the smartwatch market has not been very robust.
No, we had so, like 700,000 Android Wear devices sold to date.
Right. Yeah. So you have that. You have Pebble, and then just kind of everything else.
Yeah. Right. And Pebble is probably outsold Android Wear.
It wouldn't surprise me.
That's my guess. I don't have hard numbers on that, but I would assume they've outsold Android Wear. But Apple will certainly end up beating Pebble.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out where to go to. Let's go to, all right, so that's the opening week. Let's go to, let's go straight to Roger K.
Oh, let's do.
Because Roger K, a longtime analyst with Apple, he's been covering Apple or writing about Apple for at least as long as I have. But at some point he turned into this weird curmudgeon. One of these guys in the in the, you know, the Church of Apple Doom. He's got faith that Apple is, you know, going to fail despite all evidence to the contrary. But he's a believer. And the Apple Watch, he's one of these guys who was just poo-pooing the Apple Watch before it was released on Friday. The same day that that pre-orders actually went on sale. No, maybe, I guess before pre-orders went on sale. He published a piece over at Forbes saying that he didn't think the Apple Watch was going to do well because he was in some sort of meeting with a bunch of Silicon Valley tech executives, and he asked them which ones would be buying an Apple Watch, and none of them raised their hand, so therefore the Apple Watch is, it's just, you know, meh, not going to do anything.
Well, there you go. Apple is doomed.
Yeah, pretty much. The Apple Watch is doomed at the very least. I don't know that Roger K has said that Apple is doomed, but he was certainly saying that the Apple Watch was going to be a flop. And so what do you do when you're one of these people, when you're one of these people who is just like, yeah, Apple Watch is not going to do anything. Just like, you know, the iPhone's not going to do anything. The iPad's not going to do it. You know, when you're one of those people, what do? When yet again, Apple kicks butt with a new product, what do?
You reject their reality and substitute your own.
Yes, apparently. Apparently, rather than actually, you know, just saying, oh, well, it turns out I was wrong. Just like every other numbnut out there who's, oh, this, it just drives me nuts. I mean, this, I don't even understand what's going on with them. The train agrees with me.
I like it when you get all wound up like this. It's fun.
So he put out this piece on Monday where he said that, yeah, okay, fine. So Apple is, you know, these things are selling just fine. So one of my readers challenged me to put my own predictions out there. This is what he said. And so he didn't really put his own predictions out there. He just glommed off of the work of someone else, saying what he said. He looked at this sort of this aggregate of analyst predictions for Apple Watch sales, and they ranged from 8 million to 40 million. There was one at 8 million. That's Gene Munster, the notorious Apple bull, was actually like way on the bear side for Apple Watch. One person at 8 million, and the next person up was like 15 million. And then two people at the high end, 40 million and 41 million. 40 million was Robert Paul Leoto, who used to write for us and is usually quite accurate with his estimates. And then Trip Chowdhury was at the highest of the high end with 41 million units. This is the guy who'd said that Apple was destined for irrelevancy if they didn't release a new product in, what, 30 days, something like that? This was a year ago.
30 or 60 days. I can't remember what it was. Yeah. And they didn't release a product. He didn't get on his pedestal or at his pulpit screaming hellfire and brimstone, and Apple doesn't seem to have faded into irrelevance.
Yeah, not quite. But funny enough, he's way at the high end. He's estimating 41 million. And then everyone else was in this 15 million to 30 million range. And the average...
Wait. He went from Apple is doomed because they haven't, or they're not going to announce something in 60 days, to being the poster child for how amazingly powerful Apple Watch sales are going to be.
Yes.
All right. Just wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything there.
Nope. The average of these analysts was 22.5 million. And what Roger K did is he said, okay, so I've got this chart, and he shows you the chart. And he says, so I tell you what, if Apple sells 50 million Apple Watches And then he said, because that's right about the high-end plus a couple of million units is what he said. Then I'll wear a t-shirt saying Tim Cook was right. I love Tim Cook and he was right and I was wrong. And I'll post a photograph of that, of me in that t-shirt everywhere. LOL. And it just infuriated me. It's so disingenuous, and it's just complete and utter garbage. So let's start at the beginning.
Okay, let's.
50 million units is not more or less at the high end of estimates.
It's way above.
It's 22% above the highest of the high end. And the highest of the high end, the 40 million, it's 25% above 40 million, 22% above 41 million, was itself way above the high end. It's also more than twice, it's like 120% of the average. So Roger K is saying that he will magnanimously acknowledge that the Apple Watch is a success as long as it does 120% more than the average of what everybody else thinks it'll do. And 20% above the bulliest of all the bulls. And he presents it as, you know, as if he's like, you know, sort of graciously, you know, throwing Tim Cook a bone for the Apple Watch. And the reality is he was just wrong about the Apple Watch. He was always wrong about the Apple Watch. Time has proven that he's wrong about the Apple Watch. And if he had any integrity, he would just say that. And he would say something along the lines of, well, it turns out I was wrong about the Apple Watch, just like everybody like me is always wrong about what Apple is going to be doing. If he had any integrity.
That would have been the cool thing to do.
Would have been the appropriate thing to do. Here's the really insidious part of what he did. Here's what really, really infuriates me about it. By pretending to set a reasonable bar that is actually set in Fantasyland, which is that Apple would sell 50 million Apple Watches in the first year. When Apple doesn't do that, he will then be able to, from his perspective, claim that Apple Watch is in fact a failure, just like he always said, because it only sold 15 million units, 20 million units, 40 million units.
Which is amazing in and of itself. I mean, okay, if Apple sells 2 million units, I think they've already topped everyone else.
Yes. Well,
and if they sell, like, if they hit 5 million units, they've topped everyone else if you lump everyone else together.
To be fair, Apple does have a standard that is far and above everyone else's standard. I mean, 2 million units for Apple Watch, that's probably a why bother for Apple at this point. They make so much money. If Apple only sells 2 million Apple Watches in the first year, it probably is legitimately a failure. Doesn't matter that it way outsold Android Wear. What it really means is that wrist-top computing is not yet here and may not ever be here.
Yeah. I don't know about... Okay, never mind. I was about to say you're wrong on wrist-top, but I was really thinking wearables. Wearable computing is going to be an important thing at some point.
Correct.
And wrist-top... That may not include our wrists.
And wrist-top computing will probably be a part of that. And the reality is that Apple's going to sell more than 2 million. Apple is at least going to sell 5 to 10 million of these things in the first year.
I think that's a reasonable expectation.
Even then, we still might not be able to proclaim it a success. Here's where I think the Apple Watch should be considered a success. If Apple can sell 3 to 5 million Apple Watches a quarter and keep doing that, Apple Watch will be a success. Because, you know, all these pre-orders went to, you know,
they went to people like us, people like our listeners.
Yeah, fans of Apple, maybe even fans of gadgets, you know, fans of wrist-top computing, people who are really keen on that. They didn't necessarily go to normal folks yet.
Right. Although normal folks are showing interest in Apple Watch.
They are
already.
They are, and let's actually save that for the gold discussion.
Yeah, I'm totally like jumping ahead of you on everything.
That's quite all right. So that's a reasonable bar. 3 to 5 million units a quarter means that Apple has finally made wearables a thing, an actual thing that real people do. If Apple can sell more than that, it's a fantabulous success.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
But Roger Kay wants Apple to sell 12.5 million a quarter before he will, you know, again, magnanimously allow that Tim Cook was right and he was wrong.
And then spend $15 to make a t-shirt.
Yeah. Well, no, he's going to post it to Instagram too. It's going to take some effort. And he's going to post links to Instagram.
Oh, man. Yeah,
he's really going out.
And it's, yeah.
It infuriates me. It's so disingenuous. It's so preposterous. And it's just ham-fisted, too. But I get, you know, when you live in the Church of Apple Doom, when you live in this faith-based world where Apple just isn't doing it right, despite all evidence to the contrary, you know, I guess these are the depths to which you must go.
The measures you must take.
Yeah. Yeah, it just drives me nuts, man. It really drives me nuts. It drives me nuts.
I hadn't picked up on that.
Yeah. Super annoyed. Super, 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 super annoyed. All right. Anyway, that's Roger. That's Roger K. So then you and I both went in. You went in on Friday, same day for you, next day for me, and then I went in the day after that on Saturday mm-hmm. to try them on. So what'd you think?
I was very impressed. The whole process from when I walked in the door to let Apple staff know that I was there for my appointment to the point where I was done and leaving the store. The whole thing was an amazing experience. I walked in and the first employee I saw, they're like, "Hi, how can I help you?" And I told them that I was a few minutes early for my try-on appointment. They're like, oh, great. Okay. This person right over here, they can get you checked in and we'll make sure that you're taken care of. And they actually started my try-on appointment early. They had all the watches that I had favorited. They were happy to pull out all these other watches. And it was very clear to me that while I was being taken care of through my try-on process, I was the single most important person in the store for that employee.
Right.
And I mean, it was great. And even when, okay, this wasn't exactly a fair thing for me to do, but it worked out beautifully. I picked up a watch and I went to put it on my right wrist exactly as I always do because I'm left-handed and so I prefer a watch on my right mm-hmm. wrist. And I put it on my wrist, or I was putting it on my wrist exactly the way I've always done it, where I put it so that the crown is facing up my arm instead of down towards my mm-hmm. hand. So it's right side up. And as I'm laying the watch on my hand, the employee, he's like, "Oh, I see you're putting it on your right wrist. And what we recommend for left-handed people that wear their watches that way is that you turn it over so that the crown faces down towards your hand." And then he's like, "Here, let me show you."
Nice. Yes. And similarly, I had a young lady, mid-20s at the oldest, maybe a little younger, who she was not a watch person. She had all sorts of bracelets and bangles on one arm, but she's not a watch person. And when I took off my Zenith, she said, "Oh, I see you're a mechanical watch. You wear a mechanical watch. That one looks like it has lots of complications." And it was done to connect with me, right? I mean, she obviously didn't.
She's not a watch person, and she knew what complications
right.
were. I didn't know what complications were until you and Dave told me.
Right. And like I said, it was very obvious that it was an attempt to connect with me, and that speaks well of her training, and that Apple has really, really paid attention to the kinds of people that are going to be looking at the Apple Watch, and the retail experience so far is I think it's outstanding. It'd probably be a little more outstanding if you could actually walk out with one, but you know, that's just nitpicking.
Yeah. Hey, you remember when you took me into a high-end watch store?
Yeah, it was actually probably a mid-range watch store, but yes.
Okay. So, well, that tells you how much I know about that part of the watch market, because to me, it was like a crazy high-end watch store, and you're like,
yeah, the brands were, they were selling, you know, like $5,000 to $10,000 watches.
Yeah, and so for me, it was an amazing experience just to see these watches where I'm pretty sure there was nothing in the store that cost the price of my car or less.
And you'll notice I did not walk out with one.
That's true. But it was very obvious when we walked in that I was not there as someone that was in the market to buy a watch.
They probably thought you were my boyfriend.
They probably did. Yeah. But they treated me as if I was there to buy a high-end watch out of their store.
Yeah. And it was intimate. It was intimate in that, you know, the there weren't that many people in the store. And you know, everybody was so we had the one guy that was talking to us. Right, the one salesman who was the one-on-one guy, but then the other sales staff just naturally took on the support role, right? You know, they brought you water, without being obtrusive about it. You know, all these things. It was a high-end watch, mid-range store, but you know, a fine timepiece experience, and
that's what my Apple Watch try-on reminded me of.
And that's fascinating to me. I didn't quite walk away with that feeling. But I think it's because my particular Apple store that I went to was jam-packed full of people. It was incredibly personal, and they took extraordinarily good care of me. The young lady took very, very good care of me. But anyway, I find it interesting that that's what you thought.
Yeah. And I think that says a lot about the training Apple's retail staff has been getting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I am astounded by the training. The left-handed thing for you without missing even the tiniest beat. The young woman who doesn't know watches from slide rules, who understood that, you know, A, watches have complications, and B, that my watch was one such watch. So, I mean, that really does speak to the high level of training that these people have gotten. And and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes. And it's going to be, it's kind of tying back to what we're talking about, ongoing sales. The opening sales are one thing, and that's great that Apple had such a great weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's really going to matter is once we actually start getting these things on people's wrists, if they then find that they want or need to wear it all the time and do or do not, and B, tell their friends that, you know, if they're able to make a compelling case for their friends to buy one. So, you know, whether or not sales continue.
Yes, that's going to be a big thing. And we I don't think we really know how well sales are being maintained for a couple months. because
maybe even a few quarters, and maybe even Christmas.
That's true. The first couple months, what I'm saying is we can't take those as the guideline for how Apple Watch sales are going to go overall.
Right. And Apple also has to be able to meet these sales. You know, it took a half hour to get availability pushed out to June and July. Like, what is it right now? I haven't checked it today.
But I'm betting it hasn't made a move back from July. It's probably moving farther out.
Yes, unless, of course, Apple was actually being
conservative on their shipping estimates.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, it would surprise me if they're being conservative to a degree, because
June, still showing June.
Oh, okay. Well, that's impressive.
This is for the 38 millimeter white sport, looking at the 42 millimeter white sport availability in June.
Look at the black watches.
Good call.
And it wouldn't surprise me if Apple is
June.
Still June. All right.
Still June.
Yeah. Apple is a master of the Scotty principle, which means overpromise and underdeliver.
Underpromise.
Thank you. Holy crap.
Yes.
At the same time,
Apple has also had a week to get a better handle on what demand is going to be like. So, you know, juggling the supply side is best, or the supply chain as best they can, which Apple is the best at doing.
Yes. Yeah, they are. That's right. One of Tim Cook's specialties.
Yeah, either that or no one's buying it. Like, everyone who's bought one has now bought one. It's one of the two. I'm going to go with the former than the latter.
I'm betting you're right.
All right, so we're running out of time.
How did we manage that?
We had Brian Gossard sent us a note. Send us a couple notes, by the way. He likes our intern jokes, but that's beside the point. He don't really have time to read it all. He expressed a little distaste about seeing celebrities showing off gold Apple watches. He kind of thinks it's, he said it made him feel a little bit, I think he used the word icky. Is that right?
I think it was icky, yeah.
It feels gross, is what he said.
Oh, okay.
Just feels icky. I'm excited to get my watch on the 24th, But here's the thing. So Apple has sent out gold Apple watches to celebrities. And the thing is, you need to understand the point of the gold Apple watch. And the point of the gold Apple watch is not to be bling. It's not to try to gouge people who have too much money and just make a bunch of money. Because Apple's probably not even going to necessarily sell a lot of those gold Apple Watches. The point of the gold Apple Watch is to place this device in the minds of people and position it as more than a device.
Right. Yeah. The gold Apple Watch is a push into the fashion industry.
Yes, it's to make, you know, all Pebble, Geek's device. It's Pebble is cool.
Pebble is cool, but
I'm a fan of the Pebble.
But you're not going to wear one around town.
I'm referring to you specifically. That doesn't necessarily say anything. It's a geek's device. It's a gadget lover's device. Android Wear products are largely for gadget lovers and geeks. Something like Apple understood that for wearable computing to become a thing, it has to transcend that. It must be more than just a gadget for geeks.
Right, and that's why you need a gold watch, and you need to see it on Katy Perry's wrist.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It's not because Apple thinks that people are going to rush out and buy a gold one. It's so that people see it being used as a fashion statement. That is the entire role of the gold and the rose gold Apple Watch. It's so that this device is seen as a fashion statement, so that it transcends merely being a device, merely being a piece of technology, merely being wrist-top technology. It becomes a fashion statement, and that is the way for these things to go mainstream. And to me, when I look at that device, when I look at this, these reactions, when I look at celebrities showing off their Apple Watch bling, that's what I see. And understanding that role, for me, I mean, I get where Brian's coming from, but for me, that's definitely not how I see it.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's, while it would be great if there were other ways to market a product that that appealed to a wider range of people, great. Mm-hmm. That's not how our world works.
No, it really isn't. All right, one last thing for us to mention.
Yes.
Before we get out of here, we got another piece of email from Michael Lee, who said that he placed his pre-order and then went to go try it on, and he found it to be too clunky. He didn't like the way the sport fit on him, and he canceled his order. He didn't see any clear use for the watch, and this kind of speaks to like Michael, me, you, and Dave.
Mm-hmm.
All four of us had different reactions to the try-ons. Like, the sport is too light. I'm tense about it. For Dave, he liked the lightness of the sport and didn't like the way the stainless steel fit on him.
The stainless steel was way too heavy for me, and I didn't like how it fit. The 38 millimeter sport was the right weight and the right size.
And then Michael Lee, our listener, didn't care for it at all. So we have four people, four incredibly different reactions. This just speaks to the fact that what you put on your wrist is incredibly personal. There is no right or wrong in this issue. There are many things in life where there are absolutes, but watches are not one of them.
Yeah, the line that Apple's been throwing out, this is our most personal product to date, is not just a marketing line. It's absolutely true.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, the only way they could have made this more personal is if they had designed Apple Smart Underpants.
Maybe coming soon. Who knows? All right, we are so out of time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know how to fix that. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Yeah, see, our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CacheFly, the basis by Boom Recorded, just for us. And that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
All right, so I'm guessing like in the next couple of weeks, you'll probably send me an email about tax documents you need.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Keep looking.
Okay, cool.
Got you covered.